Welcome to the Tangible Hope Podcast. My name is Willie Elliott. I'm a professor at the University of Michigan, and my co-host, Melinda Lewis, a professor at the University of Kansas. Today, we have Tom Shapiro, our guest, longtime colleague and friend. He is a professor at the Brandeis University and one of the leading scholars on issues related to closing the racial wealth gap. He has written groundbreaking books such as The Hidden Cost of Being African-American, How Wealth Perpetuates Inequality. And along with Dr. Melvin Oliver, he wrote the groundbreaking book, Black Wealth and White Wealth. Tom, maybe today you can just start us off by telling us a little bit about how you got into studying and thinking about wealth inequality and why you think it's so important.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks both to Willie, you and Melinda for inviting me on today. I'm sure we're going to have a great conversation. I'm really, really looking forward to it. So Melvin Oliver and I were best friends, if you will, in graduate school. After we both got our PhDs in the same year, he went west and I went east. He went to UCLA and I came to Boston to teach. We stayed in touch and we became much more intellectually engaged in the mid-1980s when for the first time nationally representative data on family wealth became available from one survey in the United States. Previous to that, the only data sources we had for wealth was really about the very, very wealthy, which came from the Federal Reserve Board and from some tax data and inheritance data, all of which skewed our understanding to those essentially at the very, very top. So for some slightly different and intersecting reasons, Melvin Oliver and I were both really intrigued with what this data set might tell us. So highest on both of our lists is that we had, now we're young, we had the idea that it might tell us something about affirmative action, that looking at something that was passed on in the past historically might break a logjam. And at that point, if you will, if I can characterize, the logjam seemed to be on one side, folks saying, well, you know, the past was horrible, but it doesn't matter to what's happening today and what's going to happen tomorrow. And on the other side, if you will, a lot of us were saying, you know, that the past is really prologue. And it was more or less a rhetorical debate. We didn't have any data, if you will, that could allow us to, you know, are there questions that we could ask? So family wealth, we thought, might allow us to look at that. And that really was, if you will, the ground zero animating intellectual inspiration for both Melvin Oliver and myself. Once we started to get into it, of course, we had like zero idea about about what else might be intriguing and much less how to begin analyzing and thinking about family wealth. We didn't have any models in the way of there were no books, no articles. There was virtually nothing to bounce off against, as sort of traditional academics do. We test other people's theories because we like it or we don't like it, or we want to clean out a little corner in a paradigm somewhere and extend our knowledge that way. We started to do that, and we were making some stuff up as we went along. And if you don't mind, let me give you one quick example. We first wrote two articles before we kind of persuaded each other this was complicated and rich enough that we really needed to write a book. So at some point in the analysis, we were confronted with, we knew what poverty is, and poverty has been traditionally, historically measured in the United States by income, and that's essentially it. And here, on the other hand, we had all this information about wealth. So we kind of posed the problematic to ourselves. If families didn't have any income, which is, you know, hypothetical that probably doesn't really exist, but take the hypothetical, family has no income. How many months could they survive at the poverty line just on their savings or wealth? And hence was born the asset poverty line. And we determined, you know, Melvin and I don't know, you know, what the process really looked like. At this point, it's many, many years later. We said, yeah, 3 months sounds about good. So the yellow, the red mark was, could a family survive for 3 months on its savings, bereft all other forms of income? and could they survive at the poverty level? And hence, to this day, for better or worse, there are a number of organizations that use that 3-month metric. When, you know, had we been able, the three of us been able to have this conversation 40 years ago, we would have had, well, Tom, why three? Tom, why poverty line? You know, we know that's inadequate. Tom, why this, why that? And, you know, Melvin and I, we sort of settled on, as I tend to do in much of my work, to take the most conservative definitions, because those are the easiest ones to defend. And that way you don't have to defend the metric as much as you have to, you know, engage in a conversation about the content itself. So that's maybe not a quick story, but that's how Melvin Oliver and I became involved, and we ended up writing Black Wealth, White Wealth. And I will say that, you know, we would each take charge of drafting a chapter, if you will. And, you know, East Coast, West Coast, there's like no, you know, the internet is barely existing. We literally are running off a mainframe computer, and we're running to our data centers, and we're bringing back stacks, as you probably understand, stacks of data to, hey, look what I found, look what I didn't find. And that's sort of the context that we were dealing in. And then our timeline was thrown off, because that's when, on chapter 6 or so, Los Angeles and Rodney King happened. And Melvin in Los Angeles needed to say, you know, I need to hit pause here, because there's a lot of work I need to do in the community and at my university. So those are some of the situations and stories that we were involved in. And I just will say it was, I don't know if it was the best work I've done, but it was the most fun in terms of working really closely with a really good friend. And it's kind of that mutual discovery that goes on. And we would have since my family then was, my parents were both still alive then in Los Angeles, I would come out either by myself or with my family. And Melvin and I would just spend, like, you know, long nights together, working on drafting stuff or looking at data. So that's the origin story, if you will, of our interest in race and wealth.
I got kind of a question for you. When was the first edition published?
1994.
I couldn't remember exactly. So you started in 1980, and then it came out in 1994.
Well, the data set was the panel study of income dynamics, and the first wave on family wealth was 1984.
Okay.
So the data set became available probably around 86, would have been about right. And, yeah. And so that's when we started to dig into it.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, just because, I mean, the field has come so far built off of that. And I think one of the great things that you probably don't give yourself enough credit for is, and that goes into your books after, is that you've always been able to put it into terms that strike the conscious, right? I mean, not just raw data, but, you know, talk about it in ways that help people engage, understand, see it as a problem. And like you said, like, wealth inequality wasn't really understood as a problem that needed to be addressed at that time. And so it was the data, which was significantly important, but then also kind of the storytelling in the way that you're able to build on that really made people.
Yeah, no, I thank you. I really appreciate that. At that point, both Melvin Oliver and I had tenure. And so there was some release from thinking about an audience that had to be 12 other sociologists, but rather a more generally educated public. And you know, the needle you want to move is a very different needle than, you know, how many citations you can get. And I don't mean totally to demean academic writing, but it is a very, very different game.
No, absolutely. So thank you. Maybe Melinda, you can.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, we want to return to some of this bigger discussion about engaging different audiences and incorporating research around wealth, not only for the, you know, pursuit of other knowledge, but for changing attitudes and, you know, catalyzing imagination around what's possible. Because Willie has been wanting to talk with you specifically, Tom, about some of these things since he came up with the idea to start a podcast. So we're going to return to that some, but I do want to talk a little bit about what got you then into this research and the publication around this Pigford settlement, because you just have something new that came out recently, and it's not totally far afield, but it is different. And so can you talk about that settlement a bit, that issue, and what for you as someone with now a long career in racial wealth inequality made this court settlement and the potential it represents, you know, grab your attention?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Melinda. It's a very long arc. When I don't recall with Melvin, but for myself, when we started collaborating on what turned into Black Wealth, White Wealth, for me, that was, well, this would be, you know, like, here are my projects as a sociologist. I'm going to do something on gender, which I had done, population control politics. I'm going to do something on race. Then I'm going to do something on class. And then I'm going to, what we tripped onto was so significant and so important. And we thought so critical to the conversations around political change and people's lives and communities that that in different ways, both of us stuck to it. So for me, Black Wealth, White Wealth, it was basically laying out the skeletons, the bones of racial wealth inequality in the United States. The next project for me was The Hidden Cost of Being African American. And in that book and in that piece of research, I wanted to really discover and lay bare how wealth was transmitted from one generation to another. And if so, what difference it did or didn't make in the lives of those families. And then in toxic inequality, for me, the challenge, if you will, was more political in the sense of trying to bring strands together around historic income inequality, historic wealth inequality, and deepening racial animus. And that's why I titled the book Toxic Inequality, that it wasn't the run-of-the-mill inequality that we've always had, and you know, probably always will. But this one's really different, qualitatively different, I thought. And that was a little bit pre-Trump, if you will. And so that and other dynamics have kind of barnacled onto that. And thankfully, many folks are picking up the analysis and the implications and consequences from there. So that's a long part of my trajectory. After toxic inequality, I decided I really wanted to dig deeper into policy and institutional and structural spheres of racial animus and stratification in the United States. So just for a quick example, before I get to Pigford, colleagues and I spent some time working on student debt. And I will clap myself on the back, half a clap on the back. I think before we got into it, student debt was about student debt. After we finished getting into it, people stood up and were paying attention to how student debt was really different in the black families than for white families, for a whole lot of reasons. And so again, it was trying to inject what the essential intersection was and still is around student debt. So all right. So then I am, and I'm gonna edit myself a little bit because I'm gonna leave a name or two out, and you guys can guess it. But I don't need to say it. I'm with a friend in Jackson, Mississippi, Bill Bynum, who runs Hope Enterprises. And for years, some of your audience may know Bill Bynum and Hope Enterprises. For years, when Bill and I would be on a stage together, he would kind of say, Tom, I got to get you to Mississippi. We got to do a tour. We got to do this. We got to do that. And I would say, we got to figure out how to get this done. All right. So I know I'm going to Jackson. I get in touch with Bill Bynum, and Bill arranges a Sunday night dinner for about 20 people, his senior staff, and some members of the board of Hope Enterprises. And we're sitting around a long table, and Bill wants it to be one of those blue sky discussions about what are the big policy ideas in the future. You know, it was to help inspire his staff and get his board to understand a little better what their grand design might look like. So we're having one of those conversations, and I don't know who said it, but at some point, either Bill or I or a questioner in the conversation said the R word, reparations. And a gentleman sitting three seats down from me, it's a long table, a black gentleman, a former secretary of the Department of Agriculture, says, the only thing I know about reparations is that blacks squandered the settlement and that there was a lot of fraud. I'm taken aback. You know, I frankly know what to say if I think I know what to say if a white person had said that. It's very different coming from a black man, and it's very different coming from somebody whose work should have made him very knowledgeable about that situation and discrimination within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So my response was, I don't know if any study has been done about the Pigford settlement, but I do know what families and people do with the Alaska Permanent Fund, and mentioned, you know, three or four funds around the world and the Texas Educational Fund. And the research tells us, you know, fraud and scams are, you know, it's barely in the literature. We do know it comes at some benefit to the families and individuals and raises folks and children above poverty. At that point, when we're done with that dinner, my wife is with me and a set of friends who were attending as well. We get back to our hotel and I said, you know, when I get back to Boston, I got to see if there's ever been a study done of the Pigford claimants. I mean, here, you know, I didn't know the numbers then. I didn't know it would be 30,000 folks. Because if there's not a study that's ever been done, somebody really has to get that done. Because, you know, as both of you will I think, appreciate, we're having all of these great conversations about baby bonds, but there was no data. We're working off a theory. There were all these conversations about guaranteed income. Stockton was the only pilot in the field at that point. We were dealing with a lot of good theory, which I think is, you know, sort of might well be coming true, but we didn't know in the United States what people would do with a large cash transfer, even in a declining industry like agriculture. You know, that's one of the caveats. So I get back to Boston, and surprisingly or not, I don't find anything. You know, there are articles, there's some really bad narratives out there around the Pigford settlement. I convene, then I'm still directing the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis, and we pull together five graduate students and one staff member, and I charge them with let's do a lit review, a media review. There's no literature, really. Let's do a media review of what folks are saying about the Pigford settlement, and let's see what we come across. So that's the initial entry. Pigford itself is the result of organizing and movement activity on the part of Black farmers, led by a number of organizations, one of which is the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. And the backdrop to that is that within the Department of Agriculture, a civil rights division had been initiated, which President Reagan abolished. And that Office of Civil Rights had been the hope of some Black farmers and the organizations in the South that would be the vehicle for redress and reform within, you know, a government agency. So President Reagan abolished it. And the farmers chose, and the institutions chose, the strategy of filing a class action lawsuit that covered only 15 years for racism and discrimination that goes back, you know, a long, long time. So it only covered the period from 83 to 97 or 98. And to be eligible, a farmer had to provide evidence that they had been discriminated against. And so see how the onus of proof, you know, what this looks like in a case like this. And the only way they could do it, well, one of the main ways they could do it was to find a similarly situated white farmer that was provided loan assistance through one of the Department of Agriculture or vehicles, crop insurance, weather insurance, technical assistance, the gamut of how USDA is supposed to help farmers. That's their charge across the nation. The class action lawsuit was filed. There were just a couple of numbers quickly. 55,000 farmers that would have been eligible, a little over 30,000 actually joined the lawsuit. All right, and you know, maybe we can, I don't want to stop, but think about the challenge of informing, finding eligible farmers, the organizing that was needed to do that and bring them into a class action lawsuit. The lawsuit was filed, and there was an incredible consent decree written by Judge Friedman in the District Court of Washington, D.C. And in that consent decree, he lays it out in, you know, in words that academics, you know, we have to be really guarded about the, over our careers, and just doesn't mince about, you know, 40 acres and a mule. It was a broken promise. We got to make this right. And it's the Department of Agriculture that has broken the promises. He awarded, well, I'm short-circuiting the case a little bit. I will say that $50,000 per claimant was awarded in one of the two tracks of the settlement. That is, if you didn't have the time or the evidence to support claims larger than $50,000, you would be in that track. And about 95 to 96% of the farmers were in that track. The other 3 or 4% tried to present documents that their damages was greater than $50,000, and some were awarded more if that documentation was there. It took to 2010, 2011 for checks actually to be written because it took an act of Congress to allocate the funds and the resources. And so checks started to go out 2010, 2011. And, you know, it's now, you know, X many years later, and no study had been done. And most of the farmers were middle age or older. So the challenge of trying to get to these folks, as many as we could, as soon as we could, really became paramount in the minds of the project. The project itself is a collaboration with you know, the organization at Brandeis University that I am affiliated with. It's now the Institute on Economic and Racial Equity, and the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. We knew, and potential funders knew that their cautions were a little more guarded, I think, than what we knew. We knew that the organization Brandeis could not do these interviews. We weren't going to send a bunch of white academics into the field to talk to Black farmers in the South for all kinds of reasons. You know, dialects being one of them, trust being even more critical, just a whole bunch of reasons. So the initial design and model was that the Federation of Southern Cooperatives we were going to share the funding, and they were going to be responsible for recruiting. We would help with recruiting, but they would do the bulk of the interviews. And that those of us, my team at Brandeis, would do a small portion of the interviews for reliability, to be able to answer the question, did the Federation of Southern Cooperatives just cherry pick its own membership to tell its own story, or is this a larger story about all Black farmers that were involved? That was the model of the research design. We did several focus groups along the way. We did a lot of archival research, and we did some, we attended meetings, we did some, you know, some minor scale ethnographies along the way. And then we helped to engage an independent storyteller, thinking that, you know, oh my gosh, when we get all these interviews, it's going to take forever to code them. it's going to take forever 2.0 to analyze them. It's going to take forever 3.0 to begin to write it up. We wanted to be, you know, get the story, have somebody be able to get the stories out there. So Shirlette Ammons is the storyteller, and she has worked up a series of, at this point, there are three podcasts. Because she took the audience, you know, in conversations we had, you know, for the storyteller, who's the audience? You know, who needs to hear the story? Well, first tier, Black farmers. Second and third tiers, if you will, more generally educated public, electeds and their staffs, because there's a lot of ramifications in the study and the findings for reform today within the Department of Agriculture and agriculture policy. And ping me later in this conversation about getting back to that, because there's a whole, I can tell you the history of race in the United States in about five sentences in one transition within the Department of Agriculture. But maybe let's hold on to that one for a moment or two.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many different directions. I'm going to have to figure out where we ping first, because, you know, Willie's been doing a lot of thinking about the narrative that we are trying to create around wealth inequality and why it matters and for whom. I'm interested, Tom, you know, you said the R word, and I didn't know the story of the, like, catalyst for your involvement in the project, but you're clear in the report that the Pickford settlement is not reparations, and also that there's a framework there that can help to guide pursuit of reparations. And we've heard reparations talked about in the same breath with baby bonds and some forms of children's savings accounts. I mean, can we just spend a minute? And Willie, I'd love to have you be in conversation with Tom about what can we learn from some of the progress in reparations that has implications for children's wealth interventions and vice versa? Where do you see those concepts in conversation with each other? And what distance do we still have to cover and cross there?
Yeah, great, great broad questions. Maybe let me take a somewhat quick first stab. One of my original interests was actually one of the research questions we put forward to potential funders was that an analysis of Pickford is going to inform us about the strengths and weaknesses of a legal framework approach to reparations. It might tell us, you know, where the benefits are and where it, you know, is broken or might fall apart. And I think we've learned some of those lessons. One of those lessons is that farmers themselves do not call it reparations. In fact, in our first meeting of the two teams with the Federation of Southern Cooperatives and the folks at Brandeis in Atlanta, within the first hour, we quickly came to the understanding that nobody was even going to use the word reparations. That this was compensation for past damage that didn't come close to meeting the damage. That was the Federation's understanding.
Is that why they...
We could test that.
Is that why they don't call it reparations? Because it didn't meet...
Farmers will scoff at, you know, their understanding of reparations is something that's very different. So this only covered a short period of time. It didn't make them whole. $50,000 to, I'm going to assume that a large part of the audience is mainly urban, doesn't have a lot of agrarian experience. $50,000 doesn't buy a tractor. So, you know, that may be the kind of some of the comparative scale to put some of this into. We also
let me pick it to one more second.
Yeah.
So But they don't. They didn't have necessarily something against it being reparations. It's only in as much as it didn't rise to the level what they would consider a reparation. So they're not against reparations. They're just not. They just don't think that that rose to the level.
That's absolutely correct, Willie. And I had neglected to mention when talking about Pickford previously that one of the second or third main components of the settlement was supposed to be cancellation of debt that was held by the Department of Agriculture. That has not happened to this day. In fact, in President Obama's first COVID package, there was something called Justice for Black Farmers, which entailed the cancellation of debt held by the Department of Agriculture. And the Department of Agriculture holds like 90% of farming debt in the United States. It's something, you know, I didn't know before I started this project. It's not private debt. That part of the first Biden reconciliation package was frozen in the courts by a lawsuit put up by a handful of white farmers and some conservative legal foundations that froze it in the courts. So that never happened. In the Inflation Reduction Act, the second iteration, a compromise, a resolution was hammered out where it was no longer called the Justice for Black Farmers Act. And this is the ping about the history of race in the United States right here. It now gets called Justice for Socially Disadvantaged Farmers. So it removes race from that package. And you know, we could maybe talk about, well, how do you, you know, now you have to deal with an administrative evaluation of what discrimination is. You know, if I walk into a hearing and say, you know, you pronounce my name Shapiro instead of Shapiro, can I claim discrimination as opposed to a farmer whose, you know, whose application for a loan was literally ripped up in front of him or her? And we hear those stories.
We don't have a ton of time left, and I want to throw some stuff at you, and you can just tell me how wrong I am about all this. And I'm perfectly fine with that because these are things that I'm beating around in my head. So a couple broad things. One would be to say, one of the things that I kind of take from this is that any kind of, if you want to say reparations or justice or whatever you might want to say, with regard, it's hard to do on a issue by issue, Pickford, wherever else type of thing, right? Because I think then you tend to have a lot of local administration and a lot of these things, right, which all tend to always work out poorly for. And so what I'm saying in this, I want to say two things. This is one thing. What I'm trying to draw to there is to say that things like baby bonds or national CSA program, large dollars, whatever, tend to be, would seem to be something that's administered from the top down to some degree, right? I mean, much broader sweeping. And so maybe you don't have, now I do worry with some of those when you have state involvement and how that looks at different state and how they administer it. So there would have to be a strong federal guidelines as to how those things are administered below might be better strategies. Secondly, I will say that I struggle with reparations, to be honest, for several reasons. One is because I think it automatically divides us in ways that we need to come together, unfortunately, right or wrong. Secondly, I will say that I don't know that it could, how do you provide reparations for Black people, for instance, in this case, who experienced slavery in all these years since then, where Pickford is just one small case of how the institutions have kept, stripped them of wealth and stripped them of the ability to get ahead. Like, I don't know what number is that realistically we could achieve that would say, for like these families who are thinking, these farmer families who are thinking, this didn't rise to that level. And it clearly did in this case. But even if we put a big, if it was the $80,000 in an account, does that really account for a life of inequality? And right. And so lastly on that point is to say that this is kind of why I shy away from reparations and lean more into what amount of wealth people must have in order to become fishers or asset builders in this case? And what other things need to be combined with that? Maybe it is a certain level of financial literacy. Maybe it is a certain access to kinds of institutions that allow them to build wealth, right? And so I think of more of making them financially capable, which also comes with a large investment of wealth, but never enough to be reparations in the sense of paying back, you know, hundreds of years of slavery and everything else that's gone on since then.
Yeah, no, you know, you're not wrong at all. My theory of change, if you will, has a different runway to it, I think. My theory of change around racial inequality would look more like a decade long, I don't know, some period of time, Truth and Reconciliation Commission that begins to highlight things like Pigford and delves into all of the institutional discrimination and racism that, you know, exists in the past and continues to exist, and builds the case, builds the evidence case and the narrative change case before we get to a solution. You know, I think there needs to be a greater consensus around the legacy of racism in the United States before we come to a grand set of solutions or a resolution.
Can I push back on that for a second?
Yeah, absolutely.
So one thing is, I don't know if that's achievable. Maybe that's just my 54 years of living that says that you might never, in a way I usually phrase it is, you might never want me to marry your daughter, you know, as a Black man. I understand that. But what I do need is for my effort and ability to be able to get me ahead in some kinds of ways, right? And so I need a certain amount of institutional support and wealth and things to get ahead. And you're going to continue to attempt to subjugate me in different kinds of ways. I get that. But do I have enough here so that I can live? Because, I mean, we'll spend decades of trying to get everybody to be, you know, racially on board with one another, right? I mean, I just don't know if that's achievable.
So my response a bit would be, if more people understood what Pigford was about, just as a case, and the, you know, the thousands of other Pigfords in different areas of government and different areas of private policy, that would begin to move us forward.
That assumes that they're not racist in the first place on some level, right? Because I think some of these people, like, it's not like we don't know. It's not like people don't know all this exists. And we've had, even in your previous books around housing and housing, you wrote about all those things. It's not a matter of like additional evidence. You might convince some on the margins, but really it's just about like, we don't want to do this.
So I think the audience for this work is not to persuade those people. I think the audience for this work are essentially liberals, maybe more specifically white liberals and other liberals who might have a putative understanding that something's not right, but can't make the case and don't know what to do about it. And I think, you know, helping to move that line around understanding, you know, maybe my idealistic, naive hope. You know, I also think, you know, that you know, Willie, your 54 years and my 76 years, we've seen enough really good, wise, smart solutions not go anywhere.
100%.
And, you know, at some point we've got to ask, you know, what's... I don't want to do the comparison of what subjugates people more, you know, a building and waiting or you know, aspiring for the unachievable. You know, we do need the North Star, but I also think we need a strategy about how to get to the North Star. And I think there's some, you know, differences about how we make that journey.
Two quick things. So one is, I think this work is very valuable, and I'm going to cite it in my own work. So I'm not making that case. But my case is that is to wait on doing more and more of those. I don't know that that solves the problem. Secondly, I would say that for us to – let me stop. Because I forgot my main point that you were talking about. So like, it'll take me a second to grab it back.
Well, I mean, so really, this was one of the reasons you wanted Tom come, was to talk about this idea that, you know, kind of the audience that he was just talking about, the people that you're trying to reach are those who could aim toward a shared North Star, right? And overcome some of those, like, less consequential differences in, you know, the different ways of closing wealth gaps and setting children on an asset foundation. And can you talk a little bit there about this idea of baby bonds and children's savings accounts and how you might get not the folks who are, like, you know, on board with the USDA's discrimination of Black farmers, but those who are the potentially activatable constituencies to overcome some of those strategic differences in pursuit.
You triggered my mind real quick, just real quick on this, Tom. Was that really what I see as kind of one of the major reasons why we never get any of these things done is because, for example, even within our own asset field, we have baby bonds on one side, CS on another side, and they can't even understand how they fit together. And I think if we're making progress in that, but that's been a roadblock. And then the income people on another side, right? And in order really to pass policy, these groups have to understand that A, poverty is larger than assets or income. It's a combination of the two. We can't do one and then the other. We need to do both, right? And then even the financial literacy people, you've talked to them, Tom, they're like on their own boat over there, right? And so without building kind of a narrative and an understanding of how these, it's not that they don't understand that institutions are harming Black people per se. It's the fact that they, even among them, there's Black people and white people, and they can't figure out how they fit together and how they should work together. And to me, that's one of the hugest roadblocks to us getting anything done and why we haven't.
Yeah, no, we're singing the same song, absolutely, on this. Tragically, we're singing, you know, it's a sad ballad in too many ways. I know, we're organizations are so much in their own silos that we talk about talking to each other, but don't. And when there's a conversation, it's really not, it really doesn't get to those tough conversations. You know, Willie, I will, let's disagree that, maybe we'll disagree. It is a great idea that the baby bonds and the children's savings account folks should be talking. I think that's sort of more or less, that's going to happen and slowly happening. I think it's more important for the guaranteed income folks for us to be talking to them of marrying the two pillars of income and wealth. That in my experience, the guaranteed income folks are much better organized than we are. There's a well-developed structure of practice and now research that's guiding them, and it is the idea is spreading fairly rapidly. I do fear it's going to be the flavor of the month, if you will, and it's going to run its course. But it is unlike, you know, I think, Willie, the way you and I would like to see that the children's savings account field and baby bonds field develop. The guaranteed income movement, its narrative is about we're changing lives. We're not going to send kids to college with less debt. We're changing lives. And that's I think that's more of a grab than the asset building folks, you know, those of us that deal with that are able to provide as a North Star at this point.
But I would argue that that has shifted as of late, in that we're not so much focused on college. And as much as we've tried to bring the baby bonds people together, I guess what's been useful is that it has expanded. Even now, when you talk to a Michael Sheridan or someone, that it's not just about college, and really that was restricted because of all kinds of reasons, but it's more of a broader use, right? And secondly, I would say that one of the reasons they're more organized because they're less divided. There are things that are built into the asset field, even from Prosperity Now and the early convenings, even now convenings. You have a CSA convening beforehand, and then you have an asset building convening afterwards, right? That's been for years. And so there's always been this built-in division. And then you have academics who have high profiles and seminal ideas who are in their slots, right? And so where the income people are just the income people, right? But I will also say that we have made, and I'll give a little shout out to our podcast, is that we'll have Amy Castro coming on. And in our randomized control trial in St. Paul, combines CSAs, kind of a baby bond thing, and guaranteed income. And there's a big conference coming up this summer where we've been invited to that, a big guaranteed income. So I think these things are happening.
And the mayor's coming on. Don't forget. Next.
So I think we are seeing a gradual combining of income and assets. Because in the end of the day, that's what poverty, we've been doing income approaches for years, decades, hundreds of years. They don't work by themselves. They're needed. You can't do poverty without them, but maybe we're getting to the point where we're figuring out that it really is a combination of assets and income that are required. And I would argue even some financial literacy as well to really get people to become financially capable and give them a real chance.
Yeah, no, I think that's brilliant. I you know, when I am occasionally asked, because I often deliver too much gloom to audiences, or they think I do, I think I'm telling the story, but they think it's gloom. What's hopeful and what inspires me? I always first line talk about the pairing of guaranteed income and children's savings, like in the Magnolia Mothers in Jackson, like in St. Paul, like what we're beginning to see as a real, you know, something now for the families and something for the kids to hang on to.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's your language, I think.
No, 100%. And it's your language. I think we've all been working towards this and building these bridges for years. And I actually think on a hopeful side that we're closer to it and it's happening faster. I think one of the reasons, you know, guaranteed income is happening as fast as it is because you've had this long history of even college promise programs. That's why baby bonds is kicking off to some degree. And we're having these kinds of conversations that we couldn't have 10 years ago in the way that we're having them, right? That people are more open to big ideas than they were 10 years ago, even liberals.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. I think that for better or worse, it's a byproduct of COVID. The ability to talk in the mainstream and have those big ideas on the table, we had to sort of push from the ground to say to edge it on the corner of the table as some compromise, maybe the crumb. But COVID allowed us to put EITC, a massive expansion, on the table, to put recovery acts, to put shoving money out the door to businesses. And within that umbrella, then talking about baby bonds is not, you know, it's not in left field anymore.
I would throw in the Great Recession too. I think it came home in the COVID era, but the Great Recession began to provide some cracks. Because really, people don't want to do revolution until things really fall apart. And policy revolution, I'm talking about, right? And so we started, the Great Recession was quite a thump on us, not enough. And then you go into the COVID, and now people are like, you know, our lives aren't working. The institutions aren't working, and there needs to be change. We're probably not quite there yet, so that scares me. Maybe we need one more thump, but we're getting close.
Yeah, we needed, I think we needed to, we failed at future-proofing some of those big changes, like EITC, and I think there's a real cautionary tale there.
Child tax credit and some others too, right? Maybe we can close, because I know we're running up on time, with Tom giving us kind of any last thoughts you want to give us.
I'm not sure. We've covered a lot. My mind goes back to, in a way, to Pigford and that particular settlement, because there's a lot more work we're continuing to do with it. You know, I think in broader strokes, it's a case about land dispossession. It's about wealth extraction, and it is about. You know, farming's an identity. It's a way of life. And I think we're seeing that on the precipice, especially for small farmers and especially for farmers of color. And so we continue to work on some other, continuing to mine the data for other reports we're working on. And, you know, I just hope that it'll continue to have some traction, especially with narrative change and reform within the Department of Agriculture. Those are my hopes at the moment. and we'll see what other big projects I can be cajoled into. And so, Willie, you can talk to me when we're done.
Just so all our listeners know, we'll put a link up to the article, and I really recommend you read it because it really is something that that has made me rethink things, and certainly something that I'll be citing. Mm-hmm. And I think just provides, as Tom said, that evidentiary base for in helping people help us paint a picture of how these institutions actually work or don't work for certain people, which is really important.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the parts of the report that was the most meaningful to me was the analysis, Tom, of the psychological and physical health effects of the institutional discrimination, the extraction of wealth, and the just attack on individual and family identity and opportunity. And, you know, Willie, you like were on the leading edge of looking at wealth inequality in terms of educational outcomes and children's expectations, when a lot of folks were really looking at it more as dollars, who has what and doesn't have what. And reading that analysis, Tom, from your team in Pigford was making me think, what are the other fronts that we need to be not only analyzing, but incorporating into the narrative, the case that we're making in the public imagination about what does it matter what our institutions are and are not doing for different folks and constituencies within our country? Those were the areas where I was highlighting the most stuff and thinking about those stories and how poignantly people were crafting their own narratives and telling their truths that we all need to sit with.
Yeah, it wasn't very hard to get to. It was just getting folks to the actual interviews. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of distrust that were barriers to getting folks to interviews.
Yeah,
because they didn't.
For sure. Willie, do you have any final comments as we close here?
Real quick one is to say that it's kind of irony that you brought up how I kind of led the kind of charge on education. Now I'm trying to lead the charge on broadening beyond education. So because
I think it's a continual evolution. I mean, hearing Tom today talk about it was him being at this dinner and, you know, having a discussion with folks, the same kind of conversation that it sounds like, Tom, you have a lot. And then a spark, a provocation led you down a path of a whole area of inquiry that is expanding not only your own knowledge, but the rest of the field who follows your work for good reason, because you've been leading us now for so many years in a different direction. And Willie, I think that your efforts are another iteration of that same kind of accumulating impact in the field.
Yeah, and lastly, if I can just say, some wise person told me when I was too young to understand the wisdom, be careful about the research you get into, because you're going to have to work with those people. So choose good people and good fields to work with. And I'm honored to be in the field that involves both of you.
Yeah. Thank you. For us as well.
It is a total joy to get to have you be here. The best part about getting to have these conversations and truly a testament to how much those relationships matter.
And you got to hit us with the business part of this.
Right. Okay. I was ready the last time. I did a good job the last time. Let me make sure I can pull it out. So to say that, you know, we're excited not only to have had Tom here today, but Mayor Carter is the mayor of St. Paul to share the really innovative and very meaningful work happening there, and a conversation about universal basic income coming up. So if you want to make sure that you don't miss any of those conversations, like and subscribe so that you can get those notifications in your podcast player. Thank you, Tom, for being here. Thank you, listeners, for joining us, and we'll look forward to continued conversations.